part of my presentation is really about how environmental justice and climate justice are intertwined, and how really what's really driving it, as Angela Lovell Blackwell said, sort of place and some issues around race as well. So first, what I'll do is kind of just talk about environmental justice. Here's the EPA's definition of it, which I think is a good definition just for folks who don't have a huge EJ background. But for many folks who are in the EJ field, it's really more about looking holistically at community health and understanding access to safe jobs, you know, good employment, safe schools, environments that are free from environmental contamination, being able to live your life without the isms. And so really, one of the points, if you were in the session this morning, the Place Matters session, one thing I was thinking was that how privilege and power, I think it's Angela Lovell Blackwell and Dr. Buller said, are embedded in how we zone, plan, and develop. And so the whole reason for this equity planning movement is really to combat how historically privilege and power, that embeddedness, and how that really drives place and drive what those things are in the spaces that we live in. Oh, sorry. Let me do this differently. And so when you think about environmental injustice, you think about the environmental justice movement, it's really a movement. You have to think about it as sort of a three-legged stool. So historically, we framed it as thinking about the first leg, the disproportionate burden, a differential burden of exposure to environmental hazards and healthy land uses and environmental externalities, so air pollution, water pollution. Second leg of that stool is really looking at the high concentration of psychosocial stressors, violence, crime, poverty, the isms, and sort of that exposure, that stress. If you think about some of the work that Geronimus has done and the whole Alistair Gould concept. So you've been exposed to these things, you have high levels of stress, and there's this overall community stress. The third leg of that stool, which really gets into this whole issue of adaptation, climate change adaptation, is the access of what we call salutogenic or health-promoting infrastructure. So the things that we're talking about, green space parks, green roofs, and the use of urban forests, riparian zones, all those things contribute to having healthy communities and communities that really can adapt to climate change. So when you think about the issues of environmental injustice, you have to really think about it in scientific terms. You're talking about differential burden, and I think there are a few people in this room who've heard me say this, differential burden, differential exposure, differential risk, and differential health outcomes. So there's been a lot of work done to understand health disparities from sort of behavior perspective and also access to healthcare. And one point that you made this morning, I wanted to really say, when you think about all the money we put into medicine, the Caduceus staff has two snakes, right? It has two snakes. One's a medical snake and one's a public health snake. The medical snake is a little overweight. So getting to your point, it needs to kind of exercise. So we need to have better balance. So instead of having a medical snake, we really need to have an equity justice snake with the public health snake. So I just wanted to say, I didn't get a chance to say that. But so it gets to these issues, though, because we're really talking about how you can look at sort of race, ethnicity, SES, and looking at health disparities. So it's really more about, we need to focus more on these environmental factors, really to understand how behaviors are driven by context. And so place and environmental context really matter when you're talking about environmental justice, when you're talking about environmental health disparities, and we talk about the populations who are going to be disproportionately impacted by climate change, the populations who are vulnerable to climate change due to these underlying health disparities, whether it be lack of access, SES issues, or diabetes, asthma, or other negative health outcomes. I keep going backwards. So emerging EJ research. One of the leaders of this research, her name is on here, is Rachel. And Rachel and some other folks have really been pushing this EJ science forward and really framing environmental determinants and really understanding the interconnection, interrelationships, and sort of what we need to do as a field, as a science, to study it, and then what we need to do as a field and science to really address these issues. So major points, vulnerable populations, as I said before, you have different exposure, greater susceptibility, and then the communities are underserved by these health-promoting infrastructures. So in many cases for EJ communities, it's really going to be about built environment issues that we need to really address those issues as pertains to climate change adaptation and also climate change mitigation, as Rachel said, because of the hot spots, the polluters, and wanting to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or needing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So in many cases, when we think about EJ communities, we're talking disparities in built environment. Sorry, I'm talking fast. When you said 14 minutes, I kind of went to overdrive. Let me slow down for those of you who do not know that Mississippians do talk fast. I'm from Mississippi. So we have housing, transportation, food, parks and green spaces, and squalor. So again, these things are really, again, getting that to sort of the adaptation that we need to focus on, the areas of adaptation we need to focus on as relates to vulnerable communities and climate change. So we're talking about sparingly built environment, poor families, exposed to a lot of rental stock. There may be issues around indoor air quality, been exposed to pests, been exposed to mold, mildew, leaking pipes. We want to have good physical infrastructure for safety, the whole well-being. So if your house is not safe, then again, it gets back to the whole stress contribution. So poor people and people of color disproportionately reside in substandard housing. So this is a pressing example of health inequity when we talk about the built environment, again, this relationship with climate change. Particularly if you think about we're in D.C. and communities dealing with the urban heat island effect. So, I mean, the housing component is really important there as well. Transportation, that whole urban heat island effect is a big issue here. We're talking about smog issues. Dr. Jackson showed this slide with the 23 lanes?
Oh, it's Northwest Atlanta.
So 23 lanes in Northwest Atlanta. So it's not only the issue that people are driving farther and then you have the sprawl, but it's also the communities that host those land uses. The ecological goods and services, the community ecosystem is used as a sink, but people live in those ecosystems, so they're also used as a sink for those contaminants. So that's another thing that we need to really think about more holistically is understanding how transportation literally impacts your health and physically how you can be impacted by contaminants because your body is soaking up, absorbing a lot of those contaminants. So we see infrastructure is not, everybody can have access equally. We can see that can have impact on your employment, your access to medical care, your access to food. And if, when we think about the issue of food, many cases we talk about food desert. The food desert is really the outcome, right? What's the process? And even you know LaDonna Redmond, if you can say it out loud, what does she call the process that leads to the production of food deserts?
Apartheid.
Food apartheid. So we really have to dismantle food apartheid to really address the whole issue of food deserts. Or in some cases, you may not live in a desert, maybe a food savannah. It's another kind of term that's out there. So we're thinking about built environment, you know, McDonald's, more than what we call these pathogenic infrastructure. It's important to modify the environment so people, if they're going to have to adapt to climate change, they need to make sure they have the nutritional inputs to be able to be healthy. And right now, because of the infrastructure, many communities don't have that nutritional inputs necessary. So parks and green space as well. Parks and green spaces represent critically important environmental amenities. Contact with nature is highly valued and offers a range of health benefits. So it's not just the fact, you know, aesthetic value. I mean, we were meant to be connected to nature. Nature's an important part of who we are. And so if you think about, you know, our cities and towns, that public access to nature really provides a balance to some of the negative exposures that you may have. So you think about the research that's done in public health. In many cases, we focus on the negative exposures, so biomedical reductionist approach to health. What we need to do more is think about the positive exposures. And this work, this kind of positive tone has been some of my colleagues like Michael Jarrett and others have talked about we need to look at more positive exposures in the work that we do, particularly parks and green space. So when you think about squalor, there was a point made earlier about the whole issue of urban renewal in an earlier presentation. And that so it's important if you live in the neighborhoods where this whole broken window index, if you have a lot of broken windows, that's going to have an impact on sort of stress levels. That's going to impact on mental health. That's going to have an impact on how you value yourself and when you live in a neighborhood that may have squalor. So it's important that, you know, neighborhood residents is an important predictor of mortality. We've seen a lot of work done in neighborhood health literature by Ana Diaz-Rue and many folks at Harvard, Kawachi, and others. We're thinking about the demographic, socioeconomics, and lifestyle and psychosocial factors that kind of captured by our neighborhood. So we really need to understand how squalor plays a role in health disparities and how this will be an issue that we need to address as it, you know, pertains to climate change. So some of my work, we kind of just look at you know, communities more holistically and looking at, again, getting this process of structural social determinants and how they're operationalized through how we zone, plan, develop. So we think about segregation, community ecosystems, salutogenic features, pathogenic features. All communities are sort of going through this process of dynamic process of environmental salutogenesis and pathogenesis. So really what we want to be able to do in this work is really to understand how when you look at community ecosystems and how we look at both the social features and the built features, those ecologic features, we really can get at health disparities, but also we can modify those features, modify the environments to have more well-being and have better quality of life. So this whole definition of salutogenesis, it takes a holistic ecological understanding of health at the biological, individual, population, community levels to focus on features of the environment across physical, economic, natural, social, and spiritual dimensions. So really, when you think about the issues of environmental injustice, the interest in climate justice, again, they're intertwined, we really should take more of a salutogenic approach, not just to deal, again, with the adaptation of strategies we want to implement, but also some of the mitigation strategies as well. So salutogens are really about creating buffers. So good housing quality, or as Dr. Bullitt mentioned this morning, they're really about the amenities that the basic amenities that neighborhoods need to have. And many communities, EJ communities, don't have these basic amenities, parks, medical facilities, schools. And again, as I said before, we focus a lot on pathogens. We have, you know, some of the processes and social factors. You also have, you know, your food pathogens, fast food restaurants. You could have some other pathogens like liquor stores, check cash facilities, heavily trafficked roadways, some of the more traditional environmental hazards as environmental pathogens. And so in my work, what I try to do is kind of reframe EJ, and it's not like it's new because, again, Rachel's doing the same thing. It's just terminology. So to really look more at community ecosystems and really how can we modify the environments and how can we do community engagement to work at the local level to modify environments to make the communities healthier, which will, again, make those communities more resilient and be able to adapt as it pertains to climate change. So when you think about climate change, we're talking about increased temperatures and heat waves, as you know, heat strokes, heart disease, diabetes. In many cases, if you think about coastal communities, there was a hurricane in North Carolina in 1999, Hurricane Floyd, that flooded out the historic Princeville community, which is a post-slavery African-American neighborhood. This community was displaced. You have what happened with Katrina and Rita in New Orleans. So that flooding can lead to the production of toxic soup. The sludge could be left in people's basements or people's homes. They can be exposed to agricultural waste, so waterborne pathogens and other microbes. If you think about climate change in the West, places like Phoenix or right now in Texas, we have a lot of drought-induced wildfires. So we have the PM production contributes to cardiac and respiratory problems, COPD as well. So those are some issues that we're going to see with vulnerable populations. Think about, a lot of my work is focused on, you know, poor African-American neighborhoods, communities. How are we doing?
We've got about four.
So asthma is a big issue. Many communities of color reside close to hazardous waste facilities, coal fire plants as well. Many African-Americans live in areas where they're in violation of clean air standards. So if you think about our what needs we have, we should focus on those communities that are most vulnerable, particularly communities that live in these hotspot areas. The urban heat island effect is heat island is another issue. And again, because many poor communities don't have access to health care, that's one of those salutogenic resources that we need to develop more so folks are going to be able to get the health access they need if they have some issues around exacerbation of comorbidities or exacerbation of underlying health disparities due to climate change. So some of my work that I've been doing in climate change, just like other people doing vulnerability assessments, and basically when you think about climate change as an issue, these vulnerability assessments are not just relevant to climate change, they're basically relevant to other issues as well. So you basically take into account, you know, some of the demographic factors, population density, age, percent non-white, segregation. I mean, I think probably what Rachel presented to you is maybe a little bit more advanced than what I'm presenting here. Some of the environmental indicators, and then the health indicators, the medically underserved areas, heat-related mortality rate. One thing that we didn't include in this was, really we didn't include a temperature variable. So we actually have to include a temperature variable. But really allows you to kind of assess what areas are going to be vulnerable due to climate change, due to climate-related perturbations and weather. So this is sort of a result of that. The South, you know, the East Coast, some areas in the Midwest, in Michigan, see a lot of areas in California that basically have these higher risk scores. And what we want to do in this work is really take into account elevation. There's a colleague of mine at Michigan, Marie O'Neill, who's done a lot of work in this area too, and taking into account AC prevalence is one thing to do. And really looking at the use of AC, and there's actually different types of AC. You have your heating units for the whole home, central air and heat. You have some people have window units, and there's other folks who actually use the standing units, the AC units. So there's different types of AC. So when you think about vulnerable communities, and you have a heat wave, for example, now what are we going to do to deal with the whole issue of cooling and access? So that's one big issue, because many of our communities, particularly urban neighborhoods, don't have a lot of trees, a lot of impervious zones. So how can we use green roofs? How can we use, you know, reforestation sort of movement in our communities to really help not only cool the buildings, cool the local area, but also provide a resource to deal with stormwater issues, which is a major issue with climate change. For those of you who live in Maryland, you know we've had a lot of flash floods in the last 2 or 3 months, 2 months, right? 2 months? In the last 2 months. So that's another big issue because of the whole stormwater issue. And for those of you who are familiar with contamination in Chesapeake Bay, there's going to be a lot of stormwater inputs to the Chesapeake. Many of those inputs coming from D.C. because of the combined sewer and the sewage runoff and the runoff from impervious surfaces. So in this region, we are quite vulnerable because of our poor infrastructure, our old infrastructure, and because of how we haven't really addressed these inputs to the Chesapeake Bay. So public opinion on climate change, we've been doing work to try to work with EJ communities and communities that have been really sort of organized around addressing climate change, because in the climate change debate, many folks who are most impacted, most exposed, most vulnerable have not been at the table. So what we basically have done, we did a survey at the North Carolina EJ Summit. The Donald Smith Award winner, Gary Grant, is actually the director of the North Carolina EJ Network. And so we basically asked people questions, which climate change impact is most important to you? We had academics and community members who participated in the survey. So you see that community members are interested in the issue. So we have this assumption that because they're not at the table, they may not be interested. No, they're very interested because they are worried about themselves, and they're worried about the future of the communities, and they're worried about their kids. So people want to see more direct action on these issues. You know, rate the following climate change impacts from least important to greatest importance. I mean, they're really engaged. They want to be engaged in the issue. They want academics, they want policymakers to talk to them on these issues. What should it be a priority for lawmaking? You see that a lot of communities, they strongly agree that this should be an issue. Policymakers should really be focused on this. One of the Joint Centers on Economic Studies, what's the name? Is it Joint Center for? Yeah, so the Joint Center actually did a survey in 2010 to basically ask people in four states, Arkansas, Indiana, South Carolina, I think one more state, about the 2010 midterm election, and also they had questions about climate change. So you see the Joint Center asking African Americans about these issues, and particularly around, you know, vulnerability and low-income populations, to see what should be done around mitigation and adaptation. Let me move through this. I want to get to one big group. I'm sorry. So one big group I want to focus on is the EJ leadership. Yeah, EJ Leadership on Climate Change. So this is a group that has 35 organizations, EJ organizations, that have basically come together because of the lack of presence at the table on the issue of climate change. So they're working primarily at the national level. They're holding forums, talking with congressional leaders, conducting media campaigns. They're working also at the regional level, and basically this group has come up with 10 principles of climate justice. And so establish a zero carbon economy, protect all American people, ensure that carbon reduction strategies do not negatively impact public health, and do not further exacerbate the point-to-point existing health disparities among communities. We really need to understand this issue of health disparities more, because we want to, in a time of limited resources, we should target our climate change adaptation and mitigation strategies on those who are most at risk, those who are most vulnerable, those individuals in some cases that don't have a lot of voice at the table, at the policy table. That's an important principle. Require those most responsible for creating the impacts that arise from climate change to bear the proportionate cost of responding. Because a lot of the folks who are in EJ communities are not the ones who are using up all the energy, who are producing a lot of the greenhouse gas emissions. So why should they bear disproportionately the costs associated with addressing the issue? Develop a national goal supported legislation to transition from fossil fuel to clean, renewable energy. They major support for green jobs in the EJ movement as one way to do this. Create opportunity for all Americans, especially people of color, indigenous populations, and low-income Americans to experience a just transition, as well participate in the creation and operation of a new green economy. And here's some other sort of principles, but for me, this group is one of the main groups because they represent vulnerable populations that should be really engaged in any conversation nationally to address climate change. And also, they also should be engaged when local health departments and policymakers at the local level are doing work around climate change. They should be always at the table. And right now, there's movements to get more folks to the table, but I think by following these principles and engaging EJ organizations like the like WEGAC, like CBE, like other organizations that Rachel works with in California, we will see some positive change on this issue, because the folks that are most impacted, the people that are most vulnerable, in many ways are the ones that can come up with the right solutions for that context. So that's sort of the message I want to leave with y'all. Let's work with the folks that are most vulnerable. Let's work with EJ groups, because environmental justice and climate justice are very much intertwined. Thank you.